Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This podcast is supported in part by the Bertha Foundation.
Hello, Irrational Fear listeners. Dan Illich here. This is one of our semi-monthly spin-off podcasts from Irrational Fear called The Greatest Moral Podcast of Our Generation. So don't freak out if it sounds a little different. Just enjoy the ride. This is my co-host for Goompoog, longtime climate change industrial complex worker, Lynn Doe. Lynn, it's been a while.
Dan, it's been so long. You've changed in lockdown. What is time?
I know. My hair is definitely out of control, but thankfully...
people can't see us. It's the dream. Otherwise, they could tell that we haven't been outside in, you know, months on end. We're looking a little bit pasty.
That's okay. I live by the beach, so I've got a nice tan about me. Now, in this podcast, Lynn and I look at a few climate stories from the previous month, and I have a conversation with someone who's doing great work in the climate space. This week's chat is one of my favourites. It's with one of my heroes, Saul Griffith, who is an inventor, scientist, engineer, energy nerd. He's writing policy for Biden and trying to get the US and Australia uncouple from fossil fuels and go completely electric with renewables. Do you know much about Saul's work, Lynn?
Yeah, I do. I don't know if I'd call him a hero though, but the work he does is truly amazing. I think, you know, one of the coolest things about our semi-monthly, you know, again, what is time, is we get to interview super smart people and get them to give us all the answers in a way that's super digestible.
Yeah, great. And in a second, we're going to be chatting with another one of those kinds of people, former Wallaby, David Pocock, about his new climate campaign with the sports community, The Cool Down. I'm recording my end of The Greatest Moral Podcast of Our Generation on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation.
And I'm on Wurundjeri land of the Kulin people.
Sovereignty was never ceded. We need a treaty. Let's start the show.
Despite global warming, a rational fear is adding a little more hot air with long-form discussions with climate leaders, good and bad.
This is Carl. Don't be afraid.
The
heat waves and drought.
Greatest.
Mass extinction.
Moral.
We're facing a man-made disaster.
Podcast.
They're the climate criminals.
Of our generation.
All of this with the global warming and that, a lot of it's a hoax.
The Greatest Moral Podcast of Our Generation.
Goompoog, for short.
Okay, let's rip straight into the climate news. First cab off the rank, The Cool Down. This week, climate activist and former Wallaby rugby union superstar David Pocock has launched a brand new campaign to get climate action on the agenda of sports-loving leaders. Joining us now is David Pocock himself. Welcome, David.
Hi, Dan and Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Hey, congratulations with the launch of The Cool Down. What's the reaction been like so far?
Thank you. Yeah, it's been positive so far. We've got, I think, over 360 athletes from 30-plus sports who've put their name to this, calling for the Australian government to really up their game on climate action. You know, this is something that the majority of Australians are concerned about and want more action. And, you know, I think it's everyone's responsibility to be talking about it more and to be pushing for action at the national level.
Yeah, this is great. It's like you have so many ears and hearts attached to kind of that community, the sports community. It's so great to see them pushing for action themselves as a community. Do you think this will be attractive to the Sharks-loving Scott Morrison?
I hope so. I mean, I think the thing, you know, the last 10 years of climate policy in Australia and just how insanely politicized it's been, I think we often lose sight of the fact that this is something that's going to affect every aspect of our way of life as Australians, you know, including the sports that we love. And, you know, as an athlete, when you talk about things outside of your sport, you open yourself up to all the usual criticisms, you know, stay in your lane, you know, shut up, mate, stick to sports.
Literally stay in your lane, please.
Run faster.
And, you know, in the face of something like climate change with, you know, worsening extreme weather events, you know, making life a lot harder, sport probably isn't the most, it definitely isn't the most important thing. The thing we're saying as athletes is that, you know, we are people who have families, we have kids, we're part of communities, and we love this country and we want to see a thriving future. Trying to draw the people's attention to the fact that this is going to affect sports, and it is already affecting sports, you know, a part of Australian life that people love. And as you kind of alluded to, we see politicians using sport for their gain because they know how much it resonates with us as a country.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that I definitely remember growing up in Australia is, you know, half of the news segment is dedicated to the sports bit, like half of the newspaper, you know, the back bit, it's always the sports bit as well. We never spend that much time focusing on climate. What do you think, I guess, will be the difference with some of these athletes speaking out about climate to reach new audiences? How do you think that's going to make, hopefully, some impact?
Yeah, our hope is that it really helps normalise climate action. As I said, it's such a political issue, which it shouldn't be. You know, the politics should be about which, you know, policies as a party you want to get Australia to this sort of net zero future, not whether or not we should get there or how much it's going to cost. So I think really trying to say to people that as Australians, we love it when we're punching above our weight. You look at the Olympics, the Paralympics, you know, you see Aussies winning medals and we love it.
Are you trying to say that climate action is a race, David Pocock? Is that what you're trying to say? Are you trying to say that it's a race?
And I'm saying it's a race, and I'm also saying that we're running dead last.
Sometimes it feels like we're not even in the race. And I have to admit, I spent a lot of this morning thinking back to the Stephen Bradbury moment at the Winter Olympics. And I'm like, well, maybe, you know, we're about to swoop in at some point. Is that going to happen? But
well, I think that analogy is terrible because it implies that all the other stronger countries fall over and we need them.
That is true. That is true. It's a bit mercenary.
I mean, you're spot on. Yeah. This is, we're running dead last and we're refusing to even play by the rules. So we all know we need to do better than that. We can do better than that. And you know, that's maybe the other thing that's missing from the debate in Australia is you hear politicians talk about, oh, the costs of action. But one, no one's talking about the costs of inaction, which are, you know, hard to even comprehend if you believe scientists. But then also the opportunity for Australia. We're the sunniest, windiest country in the world. It's insanity that we aren't a renewable superpower already or well on our way to becoming that. So I think it's, you know, it requires a real change in mindset around the debate. This is an opportunity for us that we have to take because, you know, as Australians, we love places like the Great Barrier Reef and, you know, other just incredible parts of this country, the Daintree.
Even from a sport focus, Dave, like, you know, kids playing soccer in the middle of the day on a weekend is going to be extremely difficult in a few years, particularly in places like Western Sydney. Like, it's the heat islands that are going to be attracted around school zones, around tarmacs, around playgrounds. Like, being a young athlete is going to be harder than ever. Like, it's going to be so difficult. Your brain capacity loses capacity as carbon dioxide fills up the atmosphere. Like, these things are just going to be really, really hard to do in the future. Like sport has a lot to say. Like, I don't feel like you have to say much, you know. you can say like, for the longevity of our children's future, or the longevity of sport in general, like, we need proper climate action for sure.
Yeah. One of the guys who's signed the letter and is really leading on this is Pat Cummins, one of the best fast bowlers in the world.
He's got to stand outside and out in the sun for so long.
Well, and you know, he grew up, he got his start playing cricket in Penrith. And, you know, scientists are saying that places like Penrith are heading towards 50 degrees Celsius days in summer. Like, try playing a summer sport where you're standing outside all day in 50 degrees Celsius.
Yeah. In 2018, Penrith was the hottest city in the world. Yeah.
So, you know, this is real. It's here. And, you know, there's a long list of how it's already affecting sport, from early retirements at the Australian Open, bushfire smoke forcing a number of events to be cancelled, relocated. And then, you know, the thing that probably, to your point about kids, is probably not front of mind for most people is the effect that this is going to have on regional communities
as well.
Where sport is such an important part of life, you know, it's where people can come together. And we're already starting to see some of those sports clubs really struggling to afford their premiums, which are going up due to flood and fire risk. Mm-hmm. And then in the recent drought, there were whole bunch of regional grounds that were just too hard. Like, they couldn't water them. They're rock hard. They're too dangerous to play. So, you know, you can't use those grounds anymore. Yeah. All these things that we, you know, you don't really think about when you hear someone talk about climate change, but, you know, they're increasingly real. And you read the latest IPCC report and, you know, the time for action, we have to be upping our game.
Yeah, and I think these everyday consequences are just the reminder that sometimes an IPCC report can feel a bit abstract until you boil it down to, here's this activity you love doing that you might not be able to do in a couple of years' time. What would you say to all of our listeners in terms of how could they maybe raise and start this conversation within their communities, sport or otherwise? Because, you know, it's not the normal thing that people expect. Any hot tips?
Well, having just launched the Cool Down, I'd say you can head to thecooldown.com.au and join and sign alongside your favorite athletes. But then, you know, in a day-to-day thing, this is something we should be talking about as a community and should be on the news most nights. This is something that we're going to have to adapt to. And, you know, if we act really strongly as a country and show some international leadership, we can avoid some of the worst that is to come, should we not act. So talk about it in your community. And then obviously the politics, you know, all this individual action doesn't add up to much unless it's scaled by politics. So get hold of your local politicians. And then, you know, we've got an election coming up. Vote for your future. Vote for the future of your kids. Find a candidate who is going to make decisions in the best interest, and that may be an independent. You know, and if there isn't someone, consider rallying around someone or running yourself. This is just, it's so important that we begin to take action soon.
David, on the political question, will we see in the future national teams not going to the Lodge or not going to Kirribilli House to spend time with the Prime Minister for a Photoshop with the harbour in the background? Is that something you can see in the future for national sides deciding to make a call on climate and say, no, we won't be part of Scott Morrison's photo opportunity?
Well, we're seeing climates, you know, start to really gain, I guess, consciousness around the world. When, you know, when you look at businesses and climate risk is starting to factor in, you know, we this really interesting push in the UK around legislating ecocide as a crime. You know, to me, that really points to people are increasingly going to say, no, that's not good enough, and we aren't going to support or associate ourselves with companies, individuals, leaders who aren't taking this seriously. So it's not unimaginable.
Question about the community you're building and the letter and all the signatures you're getting. What happens next?
I guess at the moment it's really trying to show support for strong, bold, ambitious climate action in Australia and trying to normalise the debate around that. guess the second thing is trying to push this idea of everyone having to be part of this. You know, I think there's been one of the real failures in my mind of the sort of climate movement or people who want action is there's almost sort of this purity test in a way. Like if you fly, you have no right to be saying that Australia should be, you know, committing to bolder climate action. And you see it, like if you ever post something on social media.
There are a lot of trolls out there.
Trolls on Twitter saying, oh, how many kids do you have? And I'm like, well, I don't have any kids. And I can't but offset my car. I can't but offset my electricity. I don't own a house, but if I did, I'd electrify everything. So, you know, whatever.
So, you know, there's that. You're not perfect, so how can you even talk about this? Then the other thing is like, mate, you're just a dumb rugby player who's probably had way too many concussions. What the hell do you know about? It's really... You know, those two things is one, pushing for good national policy. You don't have to be perfect to do that. And two, you don't have to be a climate scientist to want a livable future. You've just got to listen to the climate scientists. And, you know, what we've seen through COVID is that when we actually listen to these people who've spent their lives trying to understand these things that most of us can't even, you know, get our heads around, things tend to...
That's because we've had too many concussions.
Things tend to turn out better than if we just, you know, plow on our own course. So why aren't we listening to climate scientists?
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us on the Greatest Moral Podcast of our generation. And thank you for all the advocacy work that you do for climate and the environment in general and social justice in sport, because it actually has a tangible, meaningful effect. And it's great to see you doing
it. Thanks so much, Dan. And thanks for all the humor you bring to it. I really appreciate it. It can be pretty dire at times, so it's great to...
No worries. If we're in the same room, I'd ask you to pull my finger. That'll be great.
Thanks, David.
Cool.
Thanks, David.
You're listening to the Greatest Moral Podcast of our generation.
Pretty interesting, Lynn. You're facilitating, you know, a whole session on sport and climate. It's sport climate soon. Like, what are you bringing to that conversation for that conference coming up at the end of September?
It's so much of what Dave was sharing, right? That we have so much elitism, unfortunately, in the climate movement sometimes, that you have to be perfect before you can say something, or you need to have 3 PhDs in all of the different hard science areas. Yeah. But it's that recognition that the more we talk about, if climate's going to be impacting everyone, then everyone needs to figure out exactly what that means for them, their sector, their community, whatever that looks like, and helping those individuals take action in a way that makes sense. So this sport positive thing actually came out of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the same body that governs the Paris Agreement. And it's that recognition that if you counted the membership of some sporting clubs around the world, that makes up a small country equivalent.
Oh,
so
totally.
What would happen if, you know, Manchester United came on and declared a bunch of different climate targets, both for their grounds, the way they operate their team, and, you know, what they encourage their fan base to do. So I think it's just taking climate a little bit like what we're doing with this podcast, right, outside of that wonkery realm.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because people look up to those brands and they look up to those teams, and whatever their teams are doing, they'll also do that as well. That's such great position. Like, positioning those brands in a place of leadership and climate action is really powerful.
Exactly.
It's not unlike if Australia was a good actor on the world stage in climate, we could also be a leader and encourage others to do good things on climate as well. So,
your reputation matters. And I think where you lend your reputation and your voice as well, again, is super important. Again, I think back to, do you remember a couple of months ago, Ronaldo was at a press conference, I think it was, and there was a bottle of Coke there.
And he replaced it with water.
Yeah, he replaced it with water. And obviously for me, I was like, oh my God, it was still a plastic water bottle. But it's that recognition of, if you're going to be a top athlete, why would you be promoting that kids essentially drink sugar? And then the impact that had on, you know, the stock value of Coca-Cola for the next, you know, couple of days is just that indicator of the signal that the sports community or other communities could be sending to their fans.
Well, I want people listening to this podcast. I'm drinking a cup of tea, so I can't wait for the stock value of, what am I drinking? Madura tea to go up.
To go up, exactly. Yeah. Positive brand association, that's what you are. Top influencer. Look,
I think because we had a special guest, we've probably run out of time for the climate news. I think there's one thing I think there's one thing we shouldn't mention, though, is the ACF survey, which just came out this week, which is incredible. They found that every single electorate, Australians want climate action. That's amazing. 60%, 67% of voters believe the government should be doing more to address climate action, including a majority in all 151 national seats. This is such a huge survey. This is amazing.
And it's the narrative that we haven't been hearing, right? We've been hearing that this is something about, you know, regional communities versus inner city, like
latte sipping
people. But actually, every single community wants climate change, and maybe what action they want looks a little bit different, but the direction that everyone wants to be heading in is definitely the same. We need to be doing
more. And the difference
more.
Between the city and the regionals is negligible. It's like 3% exactly. difference. Like six, it's in the 60-somethings percent. It's like, so when Michael McCormack or other nationals say, well, you people in the cities, you don't understand. Well, it's actually you people in the regions also understand.
And want you. More or less exactly the same thing. I think this would be really cool if it could be overlaid with realestate.com. So, you know, when we're browsing property aspirationally, not because we can afford anything, but we can figure out, you know, what community should I be living in if I either want to spend all of my time changing my neighbor's opinion or spending time in my little bubble of, you know, pro-climate action people. This is how I want to live.
We're all moving to the seat of Durack, I believe, in Western Australia, which is about the size of Germany. So
can't wait. Love it. Love it.
Lynn, I want to talk about COP, but we've kind of run out of time this podcast. So next month, let's talk about COP, and because we'll be about a month out from COP starting. It'd be great to hear from you where Australia is heading into COP, and I think we'll probably know more by then as well.
We definitely will. I mean, fingers crossed that it's even going ahead. There's been actually a call over the last couple of weeks that maybe we should postpone the conference again. If countries, you know, particularly emerging economies, the countries that will be most affected by climate change, can't be there because of the COVID vaccination rollout situation globally.
Well, that is a frightening thing to think about. Thanks, Lynn, for joining us again on the Greatest Moral Podcast of Our Generation. We'll see you next month.
Yes, can't wait.
And right now, we've got Saul Griffiths. Great interview I did with him earlier this week. He is an absolute brain. And as you can hear in my interview, Lynn, if
your brain ticking over as you're catching up.
I'm a little bit too excited. I'm a little bit too excited to talk to
Saul. Can't wait to hear you fanboy.
My guest on this episode of the Greatest Moral Podcast of Our Generation is Saul Griffiths. He's got a lot of titles in his life: entrepreneur, engineer, scientist, energy expert, MacArthur Genius Grant winner. He's now adding one more. Fed up with the inability of politics to meet the moment of the climate crisis heading into COP26, Saul is trying out a new title: political heavyweight. He's a man fully charged and ready to steamroll his way into any politician's office he can, with a unique style of lobbying that can only be described as bad cop, bad cop. Saul hopes to shock politicians into action with a big kick in the ass. Saul Griffiths, welcome to the Greatest Moral Podcast of Our Generation.
Thank you, Dan, very much. I'm going to excuse you for embarrassing me with the genius comment, because that was the best intro I've ever heard. I'd love to kick some poly ass.
Well, look, I hope you don't. My next question is an awkward follow-up. You know, I've only spoken to you once before. I've seen you speak to lots of groups and on online forums. Dare I say you seem a little dangerous, if not a little unhinged. Is that a fair assessment?
That's just, we've had a pandemic for a little while, and the long hair and that resembles the Unabomber is purely a coronavirus side effect.
All right. Now, the audience that listens to Irrational Fear, they're pretty smart. They've lived with the climate action journey for, you know, over a decade. So I want to talk with you about big, bold ideas. First of all, I kind of want to start off with personal responsibility. You know, in the climate activist world, there's kind of a policing around the language around personal responsibility. There are a lot of folks that say that personal responsibility isn't the problem. The whole notion of the carbon footprint was kind of designed by the fossil fuel industry to kind of put the onus of climate action on the user. Are they right?
I'm very sympathetic to the argument that there was some conspiracy and denial from the big fossil companies and that it's their fault. But I don't think we should allow ourselves to not understand our role in it. I find it peculiarly interesting that we have divestment campaigns from Peabody Coal or from BHP or from the direct producers of fossil fuels, but we don't have divestment campaigns for Toyota or for Ford, because they're those corporations, even though 2% of the world's emissions go through an engine that Toyota built or an engine that Ford built, we don't really want to blame them because it's just too close to our own personal driveway. So I think the sort of failing of this logic can be seen there. Why draw the boundary at the machines that dig the fossil fuels up instead of drawing the boundary for the machines that we own that burn the fossil fuels? That said, I think it's not easy. It is still today not easy for an individual person or household to like have all the solutions and be a perfect upstanding citizen. But I would like us to recognize that, you know, yeah, that we just done the numbers for the US and it's very similar in Australia. About 42% of all of our emissions are decisions that are made around our kitchen tables. If you include our small businesses, it's about 65 or 70%. Because around your kitchen table, you decide what fuel goes in your car. You decide what fuel heats your house, what fuel heats the water in your house for your hot showers. You decide what fuel cooks your food. And you make, you know, similar choices in small businesses. What runs the small business heating and cooling systems, and do they use petrol or electric? So we actually have a shocking and surprising amount of power and, in some respects, collective responsibility. That's not to blame us all for not making the right decision, because, again, you know, I've been doing a ton of this work in the last few years, but like, still not quite economically a rational decision for a household to go fully electric and fully decarbonized. You still have to be in the very wealthy or the zealot category. This might be a little bit why there's Tesla lovers and Tesla haters, because the Tesla is the solution for the 0.1%. The reality in 2021 is it costs you $10,000 or $20,000 more for the electric car than the gasoline equivalent, probably a few hundred dollars more for the electric induction fancy cooktop instead of the natural gas one, about $1,000 more for the electric heat pump heating systems. So as I like to think about it, if you can afford an Audi or a Mercedes, you're a planet fucking hypocrite, because you could just buy a Chevy Bolt electric or Toyota electric and the other things with the extra 20 grand you spent on your Mercedes. But for the rest of us, it's still a year or two or three away where the electric car production gets big enough that they're cheap enough, that the batteries get cheap enough for the side of the house, that the solar still gets cheaper and cheaper. But we're right on the cusp now.
I feel that myself. Like this year I bought my first car in 20 years and I bought a secondhand car, but I was really looking into an EV. I don't have a garage or anywhere to plug it in. I don't own a house. But at the same time, I was like, well, maybe I can get an EV and, you know, charge it at the Westfield or wherever down the beach where I live. But still just the price is just maybe 20 grand, a little more than what I could afford. But I can feel like this car that I've got now is going to be the last internal combustion engine.
I definitely want to make bumper stickers that are, this is my last guzzling piece of shit.
Let me write that down. Do you mind if I put that on the Irrational Fear store?
Not at all. I'd also like you to make one that's like, my heat pump is hotter than your gas furnace.
Okay. Well, no one sees it. It sits on this side of your house. That's the problem.
But, you know, the reality now in Australia, I had these numbers yesterday. It's the upfront cost that's the problem, which is part of the reason I'm trying to get in there and to your point, kick political butt, if I was driving a mid-sized Australian car right now at $1.50 a litre, it's about 12 cents a kilometre. And if I did an EV, a mid-sized EV, charged off the electricity grid, it cost me about 7 cents a kilometre. And if I was charging that EV off my rooftop solar, it's 1 or 2 cents a kilometre. So you would get that money back. It'll just take you 5 years. So what we really need is financial instruments to help everyone afford this future. And that's the type of thing that you need federal governments to help with.
And this is nothing new. Like, federal governments have been doing this for things in the past.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and the one way of looking at the Australian economy is this giant real estate Ponzi scheme, because we have such explicit economic policy focused around on helping people afford the suburban everything, the house, the home, and we sort of are underwriting all of our mortgages. That has precedent. That was actually really began, curiously enough, under Franklin D. Roosevelt, when the Great Depression had caused 20% unemployment in the US in the 1930s. The majority of the jobs were lost in the regions, and they were construction jobs that were lost, and they realized they needed a stimulus package that would put people back to work in the States. So the US federal government invented the 25-year mortgage. It wasn't a thing before then. Before that, the reason a lot of people lost their homes in the Great Depression is they had a 5-year mortgage with a balloon payment. When you get to the end of the 5 years, you either had to come up with all the money or renegotiate. So everyone lost their money, lost their homes because...
Man, that was a great scam if you're a bank.
Great scam. Anyway, so imagine, like, I actually think about it this way. You think about great inventions of the 20th century and how much they changed our life.
No one ever talks about the mortgage.
The mortgage, like, changed everything, changed the patterns of urban development. Mm. So it was the whole thing, how we do schools, like, everything was on it. And actually, the more interesting piece of that history is that it was based on the car loan that was invented by a guy called Alfred P. Sloan, because Henry Ford was very religiously conservative and didn't believe in usury or charging interest on your car. So you had to buy your Ford on, you had to give Henry Ford your paycheck for 18 months and then he'd give you the car.
And oh, right.
Alfred P. Sloan came along and said, well, I know you want the car today. Why don't you just give me your paycheck for the next 18 months? And GM, after that, went from 10% market share to 60% market share over Ford in like 3 years. It's completely flipped the market. And it was that model of, you know, buy now, pay later that became the model of the interest rate in the US. Basically, that means that the US government is subsidizing and giving infrastructure quality financing to the household. So the suburbs are infrastructure. So we need that kind of thinking because we've got to upgrade all of our homes to decarbonize.
Now, it sounds like we're really close. It sounds like there's like only a few years in it in terms of when decarbonizing our homes is going to be more expensive than it becomes the only kind of option because it's far less expensive. How long is that runway? Like, how long have we got before the tipping point is where we're putting in sustainable homes becomes much more efficient, much more cost-effective than business as usual?
The really interesting political problem of your question is it's a little bit longer than the timeline we have to keep our global temperature under 2 degrees.
Right.
So there's an easy way to say that there's a concept in academia called committed emissions.
Right.
That is, you bought a car last year, you just told me. That car will emit, it has committed emissions for the next 20 years as it burns petrol. Somebody who bought a natural gas power plant last year, that power plant will commit emissions for 35 years, et cetera, et cetera. The machines that exist on the face of the world today will emit enough carbon to take us to 1.8 degrees. So that's why you hear people say we should retire coal early because they're the worst emitters and maybe that'll bring us down to 1.7 or 1.6. You still end up in this situation where starting tomorrow, no one can ever buy petrol or diesel car again, install a coal plant, natural gas, if you want to stay on that very rapid path for 1.5-ish degrees. So that obviously, we, you know, the world only created about 2% of the vehicles last year were electric. That's not nearly enough, right? That's not 100%. Because if you want everyone to buy an electric car tomorrow, the industry isn't even at scale.
It's like straight, like it needs to happen straight
away. It needs to happen straight away. But at best, with a wartime level of effort and us like really heavily investing in our industries to make all the solutions, you could imagine maybe it's starting in about 2024, 2025. Like we spend 3 or 4 years really foot on.
Great. So all we need is like another 6 more catastrophic weather events to get us engaged into doing something. Great.
But what I'm trying to say is like, but now that you can see that the economic shift in, and the really interesting thing about Australia is if I could loan you the money in 2022 or 2023 to buy the two electric vehicles to replace the two cars in your driveway, electric heat pumps for your heat, electric heat pump water heater, solar on the roof, a big one, battery on the side of your house, you would be saving a few thousand dollars a year on all your energy costs. Mm-hmm. But I'd have to loan you at that point $30,000, $40,000 more than you'd otherwise be spending to do it. the crossover point where it's cheaper at, like, not only when you're using it, but when you go into the store to buy it, is probably more like 2027, 2028. If we wait until then, we've blown through too many emissions to hit any of the targets you want.
So a lot of folks who kind of criticize your work, they kind of say, well, the maths is fine, but the reality on the ground in terms of politics is different. How does that change, Saul? How can you see that changing?
Well, I think you don't change reality until you start changing the storyline and you start using some carrots as well as sticks, right? And we've really only had the stick narrative for what to do on climate for the last 50 years, which is stop this, stop that, you know, and largely it sounds like we're going to rip your middle class existence away from you and you'll live in a cold, small house with a bicycle.
Well, it just depends where that house is. If it's in Sydney, I think I could live with that. That would be fine.
I don't think that's going to work for everyone. So I think you can now tell with a reasonably straight face that, you know, we should be able to give people an even better existence they have now with cleaner air by largely just substituting out electric machines for fossil fuel burning machines and providing with electricity. So now governments have an optimistic story that they can tell, and you can show that it's going to create more jobs than it destroys by a big margin, and you can show now that the economics are going to work for the house. Now, the economics may not work in 2021, but they're going to work in 2025 if we make the right policy choices now. So we need genuine leadership in the tradition of, like, what political leadership really means.
Okay, mate. All right. Don't get too excited about leadership.
If you have no hope, you can have no hope. You have to try and lead these horses to water and help them discover that leadership for themselves.
You're an Australian who's been living in America for 25 years. Is that right?
Nearly.
What's it like to kind of come back to Australia and be kind of around this kind of leadership we have here versus the Biden administration from, I understand you're doing some work for at the moment. What's that kind of disconnect like?
We have to also understand that I went through two Bush administrations and a Trump administration,
yeah.
I'm sympathetic to Republicans and some of their traditional conservative ideals, but I'm not sympathetic to crazy unwarranted wars and whatever Trumpism is.
I believe Trumpism is a policy based on memes.
I think politically I'm probably a centrist swing voter. To come back to Australia, a few things. It strikes me that it's way more corrupt here than it was when I left 20 years ago. That is, like, just a shocking. The nepotism seems to have been dialed way up, or maybe because I left when I was 19 or 20, I just wasn't old enough to be the benefit of a lot of nepotism yet. But I'm sort of seeing, I'm seeing it now. I'm a bit worried about the trend. For sure, we seem to have gutted the civil service, and so I think we used to have a really strong civil service here that really believed in the country and what was best for the country. And I think we've eliminated a lot of those institutions. That gives me pause for concern. I think the best government happens when they're well advised by unbiased independent organizations. And I think that's historically what the Australian Civil Service did. On climate, I think we're doing terribly across the board. So I don't have to point a finger at any particular party here. No one's doing a great job. I am helping the White House and the Biden administration on, as I describe it, hand-to-hand combat with the natural gas industry and trying to figure out what climate policy you can do. And so I've been watching from the inside a lot of the $3.5 trillion spending bill and the $1 trillion infrastructure bill and watched that sausage get made, have introduced electrification legislation with Senator Martin Heinrich and have been doing work with Senator Sanders, Senator Schumer, just really helping them with the numbers and making it add up and what sensible policy. Having seen it from the inside, the US, the collection of Biden policy is not yet sufficiently ambitious to avoid 2 degrees. So you'll hear a whole bunch of announcements and everyone will declare success. But as an engineer and climate nerd, I can add up the math and the commitments are not yet commensurate with the reality. But it's a huge step. And then ambition brings more ambition. So here's the thing, and we helped this administration learn, like, we are on the cusp of this transition where the economics get better on the good side, on the Luke Skywalker side, and they get worse on the Darth Vader side. The fascinating thing about Australia is we win first. We could be the luckiest country if only we wish to be the cleverest country. We have the mildest climate. We have, compared to the US, we have high costs of retail electricity. We have high costs of petrol. We have high costs of natural gas. That's basically because very big, small population, big countries spread out.
Geographic disbursement of everyone.
So, and then if you wanted roughly what rhymes with success, you'd need this country to exist. Australian rooftop solar policy, Norwegian or Californian electric vehicle policy, and South Korean or German building heating policy, very heat pump centric. If you could create that country wins. And so Australia at least has one out of three. If we did these other two, we would, shit it in. Compared to, like, 5 years before America, we can do it. And we should.
What's preventing those other two? What is, like, absolutely preventing, heat pump policy and car policy, EV policy?
Well, the heat pump policy is pretty good everywhere here except for Victoria, who are really clinging to natural gas for heating homes. But there are even state programs in Victoria that are improving. So I think we're totally trending in the right direction. The Australian building vernacular embraces what's called a mini split system, which is a reversible, it can heat your house, it can cool your house, and it's economic. So we're kind of on the right track there. We just need to make sure that we never let a new home be warmed, heated with natural gas again. We'll do it electrically. On electric vehicles, I think it's culture wars, fragile white male egos, and just the lack of visceral experience of electric cars that is screwing our electric vehicle policy.
But Saul, if I have an electric car, it'll ruin the weekend. I'll have no more weekends.
I know. If you don't have an electric car, you'll ruin all weekends.
Forever, in perpetuity, yeah.
But, I'm now owning my fifth electric car. And I own four in the US. I bought a used Nissan NEV200, which is like a Nissan Leaf extruded upwards as a minivan. It's the ugliest, least sexy car in the world. My kids love it when we drop them at school in it because it was a showroom demonstrator. So it has a giant electrical plug on the side.
Oh, sweet. High.
The trauma visited upon my children.
This is your kids where they go to school in San Francisco. No, so that would be like
that's here in Austin.
Oh, that's here. Yeah. That's here. Right.
In America, we had like the first few electric cars we had could barely do 100 miles, and it was an inconvenience. And occasionally, we'd be stranded by the side of the highway. But like the last electric car we had in the US was a Chevy Bolt that we leased. Mm. It was extraordinarily cheap to own and operate. It had a 280-mile range, which is 450 kilometers-ish, and we never even went close to exhausting the battery. We could drive to the mountains, go skiing. So the future has arrived. We just haven't let it arrive in Australia, and I don't think enough people have had the experience. I love this guy on the internet who is, like, taking coal miners for drag races in a Tesla.
Daniel Bleakley, he's been on the show. We've had him on Irrational Fear.
Daniel, thank you. You're doing God's work.
He'll be pleased to hear that. He should drive through Austin, take you for a ride when lockdown's on.
Absolutely. Actually, here's a curious thing. So I'm actually totally, I speak carburetor as a native tongue, and like I sort of, part of me belongs at Summer Nats. So I'm a little sympathetic to this. I own some pretty cool vintage cars. They're in America and in Australia, it's the same. Putting a battery on the side of your house is enormously expensive because you have to pay the permitting costs and the regulatory costs, and it has to be fireproof and all of the stuff. And so you're spending $1,300 a kilowatt hour for a 10 kilowatt hour battery. So it's like $15,000 for this thing. I can buy a $15,000 battery and put it in my 1961 Lincoln Continental, and it'll have five times the capacity of the battery on the back of my house. So I'm really into this idea that your vintage hot rod toys
becomes the battery for your house.
Even better in Australia, it's like and I live near the coast, and like everyone in Australia since I left has bought a jet ski. And I hate jet skis. I have my father's philosophy that jet skis should be absolutely legal. You're just not allowed to turn them on until you're a mile offshore because the noise is intolerable. But electric jet ski turns out to do an hour at full throttle, which is what you can do with their 10, they've got about a 40 liter gas tank. They'd need about 100 kilowatt hour battery, which would be about a $12,000 battery. But then your jet ski is your household battery. All your toys become the thing.
This is an absolutely genius idea for getting around regulatory red tape. It's fantastic. And if anyone's like my brother, they've got a jet ski, a motorbike, a second car, all sit in the garage doing nothing. If you put batteries in all of those, you could power his whole 100%. House.
So you then take the battery out from the budget for the household, which is like the practical budget, which is all tiny, and you got to put it in the toy budget, which is irrational and large.
All right. So we've spoken a little bit about your two different approaches, you know, the political approach. Let's talk about the bottom-up approach. Like we're talking about these people now. We want to talk about middle-class parents who've got a house and who've got all the toys. What would you say to them about kind of their own personal responsibility? What should they be looking at to kind of get on this electrification train?
I think a little bit of this question we answered earlier, like what is the schedule you have to do this? I think we imagine that we all have to be perfect tomorrow, right? But none of us can be perfect tomorrow. And the average water heater lasts about 12 years. The average heating system, split system lasts about 15 years. The average car lasts 20 years in your driveway. You know, your average roof lasts 20 years. And so I don't think we need to be incapacitated with guilt. We just need to understand that we should be preparing and saving our money. So every time we make one of those consequential infrastructure of your life decisions, and there's a small number of them, we're ready to do it electrically. Or if you're about to buy a new house, take out a little bit of extra on the mortgage and retrofit that house so it's all electric at that moment. And that's how you'll get the cheapest finance and you'll be on the right path. So I think it's, you know, for the average punter, it's recognizing that you are part of the politics. If you ask the government collectively to help enable this, the government will make the regulations, make the costs drop. The government will help the industries expand that are making the right things and contract the ones that are making the wrong things. So become political and then prepare to just make sure, you know, that the bumper stickers are all true. My heat pump is better than your furnace. This is my last petrol powered car, and just prepare to like retire them.
No. The bumper sticker is, this is my last gas-guzzling piece of shit. That's what
I used to speak carburetor. Now I speak electrons. Yeah.
Volts, yeah.
And I think that's, like, I think you got to set the expectations at reasonable, and you probably won't get every household on that plan. But, you know, if we do realistically need to get 80, 90% of households on that plan. The challenge for that really is not so much for the top 20, 30% of households. They'll be able to afford it. There's enough disposable income. I think if you're really honest, the big, big hard problem here is, you know, the low and middle income homes where it's a real stretch. They're going to need, and they probably don't have perfect credit scores, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't really see a solution other than the government stepping in to help with various finance products and rebates and incentives to help everyone get there, because it'll be the ultimate issue if only the richest 20% of people can afford the solution. So the political risk is it'll make it a wedge issue. The political opportunity is for the party that figures out the right set of policies, the electorate will go there because it means they're going to have cleaner air in their house, they're going to have cleaner air in the suburbs, they'll have safer children, and you know, the future will be saved. All of the weekends.
Well, the Australian government is very well renowned for giving money to poor people and never asking for it back. So I think I think it'll be totally fine with this government.
Yeah, I think there is a challenge to the storyline here, and it's just the fundamental challenge for the solutions to climate change. They all cost less to operate in their lifetime, but they all cost more up front. So that's why you have to figure out institutionalized systems for making it affordable for everyone. And that's why I gave you those analogies of the car loan and the home loan.
Let's talk about grids for a second. Professor Hilary Bambrick on my Patreon asks, so many barriers are put up against residential, including proposals to introduce feed-in tariffs. Do you think suburban microgrids are the way to go instead? If so, how can we get there? Residential solar, she's talking about that.
Even more than residential solar. So imagine that I electrify your home, Professor, and very likely you go from using, again, I actually have the numbers at my fingertips, about 13 or 14 kilowatt hours per day, the average Australian household. If you electrify the 1.78 cars in the driveway and you electrify all the other loads, they'll need about 34 kilowatt hours, so 2 to 3 times more delivered electricity to the household. That's if you're doing 80% of your vehicle charging at home. So the number, you know, your mileage may vary literally in this case, but we're going to need 2 to 3 times more electricity delivered. There's some good news about that. That means the cost of distribution grid will go down because it's putting more electricity over largely the same network. But we're not really going to make it all work unless we've deployed as many batteries as we can on the house side. So that's enabling the cars and the household battery, even the appliances and the heating systems to act as storage.
Is that kind of the metric? Like as many batteries as we can? Like is that, is this kind of how, when you think about building out a house, do you like look under the floorboards and go, oh, there could be a good spot there for a few?
Yeah, we just finished building a new house in San Francisco, which I'm going shortly going back to the US to sell because we found out that living in Australia is nicer. But we went to the extent that we made all of the heating systems into storage. So we can store 2 days of heat for the whole house in the basement and 5 days of hot water in the basement in large storage tanks. That was much, much, much cheaper than battery storage. We also have a battery on the side of the house. We have a 20 kilowatt solar system, which is enormous. We did that because we're designing for the winter minimum, not the summer minimum. So we will be nearly off grid the whole year. And because we were building a new house, it was sort of fairly easy to do all that. So you definitely need I call it grid neutrality to conjure the ideas of net neutrality, which is all packets of data are equal on the internet. You can't prioritize one or the other. I think we need grid neutrality in Australia. So it doesn't know whether you are Origin Energy or Jane Smith in Coromel. You get treated the same with your electrons. The solar success story is, and everyone here knows it, and rooftop solar is proliferating. Literally the cheapest electricity in the world is Australian rooftop solar, 6 cents per kilowatt hour after financing, because it's installing at 95 cents a watt and being financed at 5%. It's crazy. To put that in perspective, the average cost of electricity in the US grid is about 20 cents Australian. The average cost.
Whoa, that's like more than three times.
Yeah, the average cost of Australian electricity is 25 cents a kilowatt hour.
So like our normal electricity is like five times more expensive than
your rooftop solar. So really, and then all of the grid operators will complain, well, if we have too much rooftop solar, then we're not going to balance the grid at noon because all of it's on, and then we'll have undervoltages and overvoltages, and they're going to give you all of this reason to not do this project now. And we're writing AEMO, which is Australian Electricity Market Operator, is currently writing these rules. It's doing it, I don't really know, but it does not seem to be going in the right direction. We have to be writing these rules now that anticipate there'll be two electric cars in every one of those driveways. The electricity demand is going to go way up, and we need all of those assets to be allowed to play in the electricity market in order to be able to balance the solar and wind heavy grid.
It feels weird that AEMO is doing that. They're usually really good on this kind of stuff, and it seems like a departure from the narrative that they've been kind of building upon over the last year. Do you know what that is?
By no means are AEMO doing the worst in the world. They're doing okay. But there are certainly players putting their thumbs on the scale.
Say it, Saul. Say it.
I'm politically neutral. I'm centrist. Okay. There may or may not be certain bad agents politically who are putting their hands heavily on the scale to favor locking in coal and natural gas as the source of that grid, also while preventing you from having electric cars, because it's pretty clear that that's how you make this all work out.
Yeah. Doesn't that make you incredibly frustrated to be in this country and seeing that happen?
I'm really circumspect because I've been in this game for 25 years and I've seen every country fail hugely. And I'm watching the country that apparently we're all thinking is doing great fail a little bit right now. The US is doing pretty good, but not great on this stuff, right? And they don't even have a national energy market operator in the US. It's like left up to the state. So you have a hodgepodge of insanity. And, you know, in California, PG&E is anything but a good agent and they basically have the monopoly. So you're not the worst in the world. And AEMO has done some good things. I think their sandbox program so that they could run some of these experiments was good. But now's just the time to declare the future is coming. We can see it, right? The problem is everyone wants to be technology neutral and still have like, but maybe hydrogen or tadpoles or guinea pigs will do it. Which is a bullshit argument about tech. You know, we know which technology is going to win at this point. It's going to be rooftop solar. It's going to be electric vehicles. It's going to be batteries of every kind, including thermal storage. And then the problem is load management. And because Australia gets to the finish line first, because we have the cheapest rooftop solar in the world, we get to develop all the technologies that tie the grid together. And then we get to sell that as technology to the rest of the world because we go first. Oh no, let's shoot ourselves in the foot and not have that success story because interest, large lobby groups with special interests.
Now, is it true? I read in the Washington Post profile, you've got yourself a thermal storage in your backyard. You've got a 6-foot hot tub.
6-foot hot tub. So I curtail my own solar instead of, I wasn't even going to wait for them to take back my net metering. I just decided to take all my rooftop solar and make a hot tub to help me with my arthritic joints.
So you don't put any energy into the grid. You just kind of heat the hot tub.
Cheapest storage I can do is just take in, you know, any, you know, I've got a little simple control system and anytime I'm overproducing, dump it in the hot tub. If the car gets plugged in to charge, I charge the car. If the car is not plugged in, dump it in the hot tub.
Great. And what does that run on? Is it like a little Raspberry Pi or you got a better system?
Actually, there's a little, you can buy a little Wi-Fi enabled plug that just goes over the electric plug. And then there's a pretty fabulous open source set of software called homeassistant.io. And you can make it sort of, even with my terrible levels of programming ability, make it work good enough.
I'm pretty ignorant when it comes to kind of that thermal storage. When you say that's thermal storage, other than being used as a hot tub, can you reconvert that storage into electricity?
No. I just know that I'm going to want to have a hot tub 2 days from now.
All right. So I want to ask you a quick question about, you know, your work and trying to be as effective on the largest scale you can be. With the other lab, you know, out of San Francisco, you know, it's just a group of really dedicated people doing interesting things, but you've worked at such high levels with that small group of people. Did you ever think, you know, oh, me and my mates in San Francisco would be able to have this kind of effect across so much from our little office in San Francisco?
I didn't. And I think actually this year has been really educational to me because I've pretty much spent my whole life in the, I'm a technology person and then work on things I believe in and care about. And so we've done a lot of impact in big solar and big wind and hydrogen and a lot of things and air conditioning systems. But this year, here's a funny story for you. So when I was marrying my wife, before we were married, I was like, oh, climate's not heading in the right direction. If it was like 2007 or something. I'm like, if the world isn't moving in the right direction by 2020, can I become an eco-terrorist? Because, like, I'm perfectly fine. MIT PhD. I understand infrastructure systems, all their weak points. I can build robots that can make it and, you know, stop pipelines and coal trains and the whole thing. And she's, you know, 2020 was years and years and years away at that point. She said, no, you absolutely, that's fine. If we haven't done enough action by then. Anyway, 2019 came around and obviously the world hadn't done enough. And I was like, hey, wifey, can I become the Unabomber next year? And she said, no, you have an 11-year-old and a 6-year-old. Why don't you take the year off to do politics and see if you can work from the inside? And the lesson is actually quite beautiful. How much done you can get with volunteerism is really amazing. And then with our experience in the US, I started an organization called Rewiring America with an entrepreneur colleague. And we sort of built this lobbying organization as though it was a tech startup. I think there was some good lessons there, and that was the right thing to do. But the real lesson that's impactful, and I think I'd want everyone to hear it, is like, if we hadn't showed up, large sections of the climate policy wouldn't have been written. There was no one in that swim lane. Like, what the people don't, what we don't recognize is that in most Western governments, we've gutted the civil service, and policy has to come from somewhere. Policy doesn't get written by a civil public service very much anymore. Policy gets written by whoever can afford to show up. You know, who can afford to show up? It's the natural gas industry and it's the oil industry. The only other people who can afford to show up because they're free or they're volunteers or they're passionate. And so we've had an outsized impact with a tiny, it really does feel like the rebellion from Star Wars. Tiny set of like, poorly dressed people with rusty equipment has been out to fight toe-to-toe with the, you know, most powerful lobbying industry in the world, US natural gas industry, and we've won a few battles. And we just need to do that on global scale. Like, you know, there's absolutely no fucking reason at all to be optimistic about our trajectory on climate, except for what my mother says to me. And I kind of really believe this. She's like, the middle class parents have awoken from their slumber and they're angry because you're screwing their children. I'm like, I actually feel like there's a whole bunch of dad bods and like, you know, slightly hippie mamas who are just like ready to fucking rumble now. And I just want them all to feel fully engaged and like, you know what? You only need three of you to show up to a city council meeting and you can change the rates, the electricity rates. We just got to, like, we've had 150 years of regulations written for fossil fuels. We got to undo it all in 5 years, and it's going to take an army of like people with a few spare hours from the middle class showing up to the right hearings, becoming a voice, you know, everyone writing to their local member to be like, honestly, we want electric vehicle charging in this parking lot and in front of the school and next to the church. And we want this, and we want that. And then show up to the meetings and make it happen. Like the army that needs to be built in 1 or 2 years here is the army in the middle that's been unheard of in this debate so far.
This is the so-called quiet Australians. Is this who you're talking about here?
That might be exactly what I mean. Anyway, my kid's in the sixth grade at the local public school, which is just, you know, magical public school. Looks like it was built in the 1950s in the Australian. You know, it's 100 yards from the beach at Tyrrell. It's amazing. The term assignment last year was design a sustainable house. And, you know, my son being my son tells us the night before, I've got to take a project into the school tomorrow. It's got to be a sustainable house and I don't want to do it at all. And I was like, well, okay, well, you have to do something. You got to build it. So what do you want to build? And he's like, oh, can we build a floating city? Because really, I don't like cars that much and they kill all the wombats and I love wombats and then we kill too many fish. So why don't we just have no suburbs and we just build a floating city? And then we sat down, we did calculations. It turns out if you built 12 Hindenburgs, four times bigger than Hindenburgs, you could lift all of the suburb of Austin and float. So we made a cardboard bottle of that and it was, you know, duct tape and marker pen. It was awful, but kind of cool. And I was really proud that he had this concept and the boldness to go and deliver this weird thing. Anyway, as we're, we go to drop him off and you got to help him carry his UFO into class. And every single other project had hundreds of nervous parent hours engaged in it. And they were like perfect architectural models of exactly the house that they currently live in with solar cells on the roof, chicken coops and electric cars.
Yeah.
And it told me something really profound. Like, we'll absolutely go with you and having a sustainable Australia, but it needs to be in the house that looks a lot like the house I currently own. And it needs to have cars that are shaped like the cars that I currently own. And, you know, okay, we'll have it. I'll add a chicken coop.
Are you trying to say there's a lack of imagination?
No, I actually think we've got it really good. And the quiet Australians are quiet because they've got it really good and they don't want you to take their really good away. And we can't sell a climate. We've had such a successful culture war and campaign on the negatives that would happen to Australia if we went for solving climate change, as opposed to, you know what, I can give you that chicken coop. I'm going to give you an even bigger solar system than you think, and there's going to be two shiny electric cars, and you'll save money, and there'll be an extra $2 million in the 2 million jobs in the economy, because Australia has such prolific renewable resources and such low population density that we are the natural foundry for the world. And instead of exporting black rocks, we should export crushed red rocks in the form of steel, which is what we used to do. And we should not give away our bauxite at a, you know, $100 a ton. We should make it into aluminium and make $1,000 a ton. And if we do that, you know, we can in fact be the luckiest country. Like, there is no country as well set up to solve this problem. And I think because we are the luckiest country, we also have a little bit of a moral responsibility to show the world that it, how it can be done, and be the good news story, right? I just desperately would love gold at Glasgow, right?
We want to win all the fucking Olympic medals except for the one that counts.
Oh, hang on. Before we talk to Glasgow, I just want to share with you this this video I made.
A message from the Quiet Australians. Hi, I'm John Citizen of the Quiet Australians. You may have heard of us, or maybe not. We're very quiet. For too long, we've almost been silenced, but no longer. It's time for us to speak up, figuratively speaking. What do we believe? Well, we believe whatever it's politically convenient to believe in. This includes economic growth at all costs, dispatchable coal power, franking credit credits, quarterly tax cuts, trickle-down economics, fracking, land clearing, and keeping refugees locked up indefinitely, like Jesus would have done. Also, if you can't afford to see a doctor, you should die. Public education should be privatised, so should the army. And we believe that politicians are undervalued and underpaid. Why are we so quiet, you ask? Because no one would want to be heard advocating for shit like this. But the quiet Australians aren't alone. We've got the backing of the silent majority. Isn't that right, Therese Jenkins, president of the silent majority? Thanks for that glowing endorsement, Therese. The quiet Australians. We're so quiet, it's almost like we don't exist.
Now, let's talk about COP quickly. We've got a couple of minutes left, and I just wanted to get your position on COP. Like, what would you like to see happen for Australia's climate ambition at COP?
Let me say a couple of things. So I read the 3,494 pages of the IPCC AR6 report, and because that's the kind of thing I do. I read the footnotes. And what's really distressing is the two best scenarios, SSP1, 1.9, and SSP1, 2.6. They're the technical names for these scenarios. They both model in more negative emissions mid-century than is probably economically or physically possible. So even our best case scenarios, as presented by the IPCC, are now kind of unrealistic. So the urgency is even more urgent than you think, because very likely those negative emissions won't come in to save our day. We shouldn't be banking on it the way that the politicians who go to COP will be banking on those emissions. So if you asked me for best possible outcome for COP26 would be, and I think it's not impossible, and I actually think you could nearly get everyone here to make this possible. You have to believe it's possible until it's proven otherwise. But like Scott Morrison goes, when it gets around to his turn to speak, which will probably be last because everyone's already thinks we're hopeless on this issue, he says, you know what, we have been hopeless on this issue. You know what? We have been responsible for more than our share of emissions, and we've been a prolific exporter of coal and LNG for so long that we sort of have a burden. But you know what? I've looked at this and I've had my best people look at the economics for Australian households, and we've had it backwards. We've not been embracing the future because we've been scared of losing our coal industry. But what I now know to be true and understand is that every Australian household will save money and will have a healthier citizenry and will save prolific costs. What the money, every dollar we save in the household will save a dollar in the healthcare system, because we won't have children with asthma because they're growing up in a home heated with natural gas or using a natural gas stove. And I promise to you, the world, that we do that by 2030, because that's possible in Australia. And we will electrify our households. The vaccination against climate change is electrification. And just as we did with our lockdowns, we went hard and we went early, and we're going to go hard and we're going to go early on climate as well. That 10 years will buy us enough time that we will invest in our industry, because we are the exporter of note of iron, aluminum, uranium, copper. We're going to add to that lithium, silicon, other precious metals, and we will more than pull our weight in the 2030 to 2040 period as we decarbonize our whole export industry, which will be doing the world a service, because we will be providing you with the green metals that will help you rebuild your electric infrastructure that solves climate change ahead of even the most ambitious schedule under the SSPs. And that is a believable story. That is an achievable outline.
Wow, that was great. Have you written this up in like Comic Sans double space font for Scott? Are you going to give it to him?
I was going to write it in Sharpie in all caps on a piece of paper and put it in front of the teleprompter. So that is possible, right? And that is what we should be doing. And it is, in fact, good for everyone. It's good for us. It's good for the householders. It's savings in the suburbs. It's jobs in the regions. It puts us back in the good graces of the world's nations for not being a planet fucking hypocrite. So until that doesn't happen, I want to believe that that's the outcome. And if Australia did that, you've already seen it, right? Germany announced a whole bunch of car companies will eliminate petrol cars by 2035, then it became 2030, and then England's like, all right, 2025, right? So ambition's going to beget more ambition. If Australia could come up and say, you know what, President Biden, that was pretty good, but you know what serious looks like in this battle? This is serious. This is, you know, we got more to lose than you. We have the Great Barrier Reef, right? We know it's written into the native poetry, sunburned country, land, you know, rugged mountain ranges, and it's tough and it's hard, and we're going to get it tougher and harder than anyone else with climate change. So I want you to step up to the ambition level that we just set, and we will lead the world, and we will show you how to do the electricity market rules that make this possible. For example, we'll run that experiment for the world. That is what we could do, and that is what I want. And so right now I'm largely just offering myself to all political persuasions to help them. You know, I've done the numbers and the research, and I can show them the rigorous analysis and you know, try to win some hearts and minds with PowerPoints. I know it didn't work that well for Al Gore, but it's got to work for someone eventually, right?
Yeah. Well, Saul, I don't want to hear your backup options for COP26, because I'm so buoyed by the best possible scenario. Thank you so much for joining us on Greatest Moral Podcast of Our Generation. I followed your work for about 15 years since when I was on Hungry Beast researching, you know, Mark and I Power back in the day. So it's a real honor and a privilege to have you on my podcast all those years later.
Straight back, actually. It was super fun too. Thank you.
You're listening to the Greatest Moral Podcast of Our Generation.
Saul Griffith there. What a great conversation. I really liked it. I don't know if you could tell. I really enjoyed that conversation. Super smart guy, trying his best to get politicians all over the world to bend towards science. Now, you can learn more about Saul because he's got a book coming out October 12th, Electrify, An Optimist's Roadmap to Our Clean Energy Future. It's going to be published by MIT Press. So October 12th, put that date in your diary. Give yourself a reminder to get a copy of Electrify. You should be able to get it where all good books are sold. Big thanks to Road Mike's, the Bertha Foundation, Lindo, and of course, Jacob Round of the Teppanyaki Timeline. He is a master craftsman. He is the reason Irrational Fear always sounds so top shelf. So thank you very much, Jacob. Probably the reason why we are ranked 97 in the best podcasts in Australia. Soon we're going to be 95. And won't that change everything for us? Please, if you do enjoy these chats we have on the Greatest Moral Podcast of Our Generation and Irrational Fear, head on over to our Patreon. We're currently sitting at about 2,000, which is great. That covers the costs, but I would love to start, earning money from this myself and, making this my full-time job and also employing a whole bunch of other people as well to work on it, including comedians and producers and video people and social media people. This is going to be a great enterprise once we hit that $10,000 mark. So please head on over to patreon.com/irrationalfear. Also, what's great about it is if this becomes my full-time job, I don't have to take a job as a management consultant, and nobody wants that. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next Friday for A Rational Fear. Heath Franklin is going to be on that show, so it should be fun.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.